Ghosts in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, and we've got 2 hours talking about the things that matter most. Today, as you know, is Inauguration Day. As former Vice President Biden becomes President Biden, he carried a message that he hoped would spark unity among the American people. I want to spend some time not analyzing his inaugural speech, but I want to make a few comments on that, but really focus on how did we get to the place, how did American Catholics get to the place where the most visible Catholic in public life will actually also see himself as a champion of so-called abortion rights? It's very strange when you think about it. So I want to go back and pick up a few thoughts from previous interviews that I can call upon. Also coming up today, we're going to have Gerard Bercherin with us once again. Again, the question of science and religion. It has been gone over time and time again, but still in the popular mind, science and religion are incompatible. If you look at the history of science, you see something very different, though. You see that the great champions of almost all the major scientific disciplines had some kind of theistic base in their life. Also coming up today, we're going to be talking with Cynthia Skadova. She tells the story of moving from liberal feminism to life. She was raised fundamentalist Christian, evangelical, conservative, Bible-believing sort. As a teenager, she was drawn towards nature mysticism and Eastern philosophies, a quasi-New Age type of worldview. And a few years later, she found herself fully embracing the spirituality of the liberal movements of the 70s and 80s. When she married, though, she didn't want kids. But something happened when her first child came along, and that begins her journey to the church. She'll join us today, laying that out as well. I do want to take some time to give a bit of a warning over the next 4 years, just picked up from conversations I've had with friends. And I'll do that by looking at the heavenly Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem from Revelation chapter 21. That's coming up in the next hour. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Alan. Good afternoon. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Matthew Handley. It's Wednesday, January 20th, the Feast of St. Sebastian. The news this hour is sponsored by the Ave Maria Family of Funds. More info at AveMariaFunds.com. Joe Biden was inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States today. Kamala Harris was sworn in as the first female and African-American Vice President as well. Pope Francis issued a statement to President Biden saying, "At a time when the grave crises facing our human family call for far-sighted and united responses, I pray that your decisions will be guided by a concern for building a society marked by authentic justice and freedom, together with unfailing respect for the rights and dignity of every person, especially the poor, the vulnerable, and those who have no voice." President of the USCCB, the Archbishop of Los Angeles, Jose Gomez, issued a statement saying, "My prayers are with our new president and his family today, and that Catholic bishops are not partisan players in our nation's politics." He continued saying, "Abortion is a direct attack on life. It is not a private matter. It is a matter of social justice." He concluded saying, "We are all under the watchful eye of God, who alone knows and can judge the intentions of our hearts." In other news, a trial date is set for the former Louisville Metropolitan Police Department officer charged in connection with the death of Breonna Taylor. Brett Hankinson's trial will start on August 31st. Hankinson was fired from the force last year. He faces 3 charges of wanton endangerment and is accused of firing his weapon and endangering the neighbors. China says it will sanction 28 U.S. officials, including members of the Trump administration, for allegedly violating China's sovereignty. The decision was announced in a statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. These 28 people and their family members will not be allowed to enter China mainland, Hong Kong, and Macau. The sanctions also forbid them from doing business with China. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Matthew Handley.
Conforming our minds to the mind of Christ. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon.
And good afternoon. Well, Vice President Biden became President Biden today, and his inaugural message was chiefly one of unity. His vice president tweeted that the American people are united in spirit. And it's only, with all fairness, we're not united in spirit. You've got, you know, many years, you got maybe 4 years to try to work this out. But the truth is, right now, Americans are divided. And there's this idea that somehow if President Trump is out of the White House, that that somehow is going to bring us unity. But the whole election of Donald Trump in the first place was a symptom of the disunity that is very much a part of American public life and the frustration that so many people felt. So obviously, yes, unity, we want unity, but we have to actually find that unity. It can't be presumed at this stage in our political development. Look, there's so much of this going around that President Trump, even though he got 74 million votes in the election, somehow got those because he was able to, you know, send out dog whistles to racists. I mean, that's an insult. It's an insult to the vast majority, you know, 74 million Americans minus a few thousand, if you want to do it that way. When Don Lemon said, who loves President Biden, when Don Lemon said that if we voted for Trump, we voted for the Klan, that's not a way to build unity. And until the president and vice president get serious and try to understand why President Trump drew 74 million votes, there can't be unity. We need to get set aside this nonsense that Trump's appeal was in his dog whistles to racists. Now, let me set that aside because I want to move on to something which is much more at the heart of what it means to be Catholic in America. For Catholics like myself, and I know many of you, we're more concerned about how the Catholic Church in America got to the place where the most visible Catholic in public life can comfortably talk about his use of the rosary, his going to Mass, but also champion expanded abortion rights and taxpayer funding for abortion. He's not merely tolerating a status quo. He's become an ardent and passionate supporter for furthering and expanding abortion rights. Now, he wasn't always. Joe Biden wasn't always an ardent champion of expanding abortion. As late as 2006, he viewed abortion not as a right that needed to be expanded, but as a tragic necessity that needed to be made rare.
I do not view abortion as a choice and a right. I think it's always a tragedy, and I think that it should be rare and safe. And I think we should be focusing on how to limit the number of abortions, and they ought to be able to have a common ground and consensus as to do that. I think the vast majority of the American people think that can be done.
And not only did he deny abortion was a fundamental right, but he rejected public funding because he knew a sizable number of Americans had moral reservations and didn't want to fund abortion.
Well, I'm a bit of an odd man out in my party. I do not vote for funding for abortion. I voted against partial birth abortion.
That's changed. He's come to the place where he no longer respects those of us who do not want to pay for abortion, and he withdrew his support for the Hyde Amendment, which prohibited federal funds for abortion, when he decided to run for president this time out.
For many years as U.S. Senator, I've supported the Hyde Amendment like many, many others have. If I believe health care is a right, as I do, I can no longer support an amendment that makes that right dependent on someone's zip code.
Now, the question we have to ask is, how did the Catholic Church in America get to this point that when a Catholic public official can claim he's Catholic in good standing and yet get applause for championing abortion rights? Let's go back to the Second Vatican Council on this. This was the Catholic Church's attempt to deal with modern culture. Problems came up as the council was implemented. Dr. Matthew Bunsen, editor of the Encyclopedia of American Catholic History, talked to me about this and described the efforts of Pope Paul VI, who was the chief pope during the council, how he dealt with some of the misunderstandings that came out of the council.
From the very beginning, there were two things that were happening. That the first was the lack of clarity and a lack of a coherent, cohesive plan for implementing the council, the decrees and reforms of the council, universally. But then there was, right when that was being undertaken, we had a series of shattering revolutions across the world, political, economic, social, and, of course, sexual.
Yeah.
And it was the sexual revolution, I think, that proved to be such a toxic impact on so many in the life of the Church, leading, of course, to Humanae Vitae, but then also leading to Paul's prophetic understanding of where not just the contraceptive culture was going to go, but anticipating even John Paul II's vision and understanding of the culture of death. All of those prophecies that Paul VI made have come to pass in the generations that followed.
And those problems included the objectification of women with the increased use of pornography, a breakdown of marital fidelity and unmarried chastity, an increase in divorce, a rise in abortion. And towards the end of his pontificate, Paul VI did try to kind of make sure people saw that the council was in continuity with our past, and he reaffirmed the tradition of the Church.
Especially in his last years, you see constant stress in his teachings, in his homilies, and in his letters about the importance of continuity, that this is not a break with the past.
Right.
And it proved to be less successful, I think, than he had hoped.
And that's true. He had wanted to achieve greater unity within the Church as the Church was opening itself to better understand the world. But there were those in the Church who wanted to turn the Church's agenda into the world's agenda. And that meant allowing contraception, even in some cases abortion, women priests, the end to mandatory celibacy for Latin Rite priests. And we see that Paul VI simply was unable to achieve this.
We were swept away in so many different parts of the Church by the revolutions that were happening around us, that the momentum built for dissent and for confusion, and it was very difficult to fix it once we were underway.
And that's what's happening today. That's why we can have a Catholic president who is also a champion of abortion rights. Ross Douthat, who's a New York Times columnist and has written on the change going on in the Church, noted the hope on the part of certain progressives in the Catholic Church to lessen the distinction between the Church and the world.
There's a form that you get from more progressive Catholics where there's a sense that there's some God-guided arc of history that is inevitably leading to a kind of liberalization where, you know, a conservative pope can only stand in the way for so long, and eventually the Church will have to adapt to the moral truths discovered by the late modern world. Then the counter-narrative, the more conservative narrative, is we have a deposit of faith, it's unchanging, its spirit doesn't permit it, you know, and extending from that, then the Holy Spirit must be picking the popes who are going to make the choices that will enable a robust and Orthodox Catholicism to sort of be reinvigorated. And this was the narrative, especially in the John Paul II era, I think, among a lot of conservative Catholics, that we'd gone through this turbulence and this tumult in the 60s and 70s in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, but now we had the Pope who had delivered the authoritative interpretation of Vatican II, and John Paul II Catholicism was destined to increase, and more sort of dissenting liberal forms of Catholicism were destined to decrease. And it was just a question of, you know, watching it play out.
And of course, it didn't really quite work out. But on abortion in the early 70s, Catholics were quite committed. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you were opposed to abortion. But as the 70s went on, Catholics in the Democratic Party and a few Republicans began to rethink their opposition to abortion. Mario Cuomo, three-time governor of New York, had a major role to play in his argumentation that Catholics could be personally opposed, but be publicly supportive of abortion. Veteran New York Politico George Marlin was with me last week. He wrote a recent biography of Cuomo, and in it he charts Cuomo's changes.
When he ran for lieutenant governor and mayor in New York, he was pro-life in 74.
Okay.
And lost.
Okay.
In the primary. Then in 1977, he ran for mayor. And then 1978, he was Hugh Carey's running mate for lieutenant governor, was elected then.
Okay.
But it was after he lost the mayor's race that he realized he had to change his tune if he was going to be, he was ambitious.
Hmm.
And so he suddenly came up with this, who am I to impose my views, my religious views on somebody? Well, first of all, anyone in public life imposes their views every day of the week.
Absolutely.
They go for a tax increase, they're imposing that upon you.
Yep.
They sign legislation of any given law, they're imposing it upon you. So elected officials impose every day of the week.
Yes.
But you're right, he's well known for the Notre Dame speech. And in that speech, he tried to make the argument that while he supported the church's teaching on abortion, he said, must I insist that you do? And he turned the right-to-life issue into a religious dogma,
right,
saying, I can't impose on somebody else, a Jew, that I believe in one God and three divine beings. I cannot impose certain religious dogmas on you, so I cannot impose the dogma of abortion on you.
I mean, he had to know, right, that this is a teaching of natural law. It's not a distinctly, quote, revealed truth. He had to know that.
Well, you're absolutely right. This is a human rights issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly enough, Gary Wills, liberal of liberal Catholics, took him to task in the New York Review of Books and said, Mario, you're full of baloney.
Good.
Okay? This is a human rights issue.
Yeah.
Bishop Hubbard of Albany, one of the most liberal bishops in the United States back in those days, said, Mario, forget it. This consensus argument doesn't work. See, he turned it around. It had to be based on consensus.
Wow.
Well, you don't base what is life on consensus.
Right, right.
So even Bishop Hubbard dismissed him. And others dismissed him along those same routes.
And we have a time now where our bishops have a challenge on their hands. It's a problem that should have been handled before. Joe Biden was vice president for 8 years. But really, this is a time for prayer because it's an opportunity for our bishops to actually teach. This could be an outstanding teachable moment. Let's pray that it does. I'm Al Cresta.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
Not everyone who's attracted to the Lord and to a life of service is necessarily meant to be a priest. So there's all kinds of forms. I mean, from, let's say, the brotherhood, if you want to stay within a formal religious context, but then all kinds of ministries within a parish, all kinds of lay ministries that you can do. So not everyone's called to the priesthood. A priest is someone who is dedicated, devoted to ongoing study and ongoing prayer, to be a spiritual father. As Pope Benedict said, one of his wisest remarks, he said, people want many things from a priest, but what they want above all is someone who's a master of the spiritual life. Hey, I'm great at this ministry, and hey, I'm great at organizing this meeting, and hey, I'm great. Fine, but ultimately what the people want is you're a master of the spiritual life. You got to be, therefore, trained in prayer and theology and spirituality and so on.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
When and how did Jesus allow some of his apostles to see him in his glory? After entrusting to Peter the keys to govern the house of God, the church, the Lord began to reveal to his followers that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things, including death, but that on the third day he would be raised from that death. It is during this period, according to the Catholic Catechism, that he takes Peter, James, and John up on a high mountain and there unveils his divine glory for a very brief time. His clothing, his face become dazzling with light. He also reveals he must go by way of the cross in Jerusalem to enter his glory. All the Trinity is present for the Transfiguration, the Father in the voice declaring Jesus to be his beloved Son, the Son in Jesus, the Spirit in the cloud that covers Jesus. The Transfiguration gives us a window on Jesus' glorious coming and our own transformation from a lowly body to a glorious body like his. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I might have gone to church, you know, at Christmas time, gradually quit going. It's not as scary as I thought it was. It's a much more warm and open place, and God really is about love. It's not about the rules and the things that I remember as a young child. It really is about the love that God has for each one of us that's so deep and wonderful.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 50 years, we've had some of the greatest popes since the Reformation era. So why are things such a mess in American Catholicism? How do we analyze and confront the attacks we're facing? How do we identify wolves in sheep's clothing? How do we re-evangelize the baptized? Dr. Ralph Martin makes sense of a church in crisis and shows pathways forward. He'll make sense of a disordered world. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and you'll find it in our online bookstore.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. There are certain lies that become embedded within the consciousness of societies and cultures. One of those lies is that science and religion, or science and faith, or in particular science and Christian faith, are somehow incompatible. That there's this historic warfare between science and Christian faith. This, historians of science have don't really hold to this any longer. There was, during a period of time in the 19th century, there was some well-known, celebrated people who tried to make this point. But really, if you talk to historians of science today, they don't buy it. In fact, there's a whole chapter in Dangers to the Faith where I deal with this. But it doesn't die. Popular culture continues to keep alive this idea that science and faith are incompatible. My guest is Dr. Gerard Verschuren. He's been with us before. He is the author of many books, including How Science Points to God, which is going to be our focus today. He's a scientist. He's a writer, speaker, a consultant. He's been working at this interface of science and religion, creation and evolution, faith and reason, for a long time. By training, he's a biologist. He has studied, worked at universities in Europe and the United States. And he's the author of books, A Catholic Scientist Proves God Exists, Matters of Life and Death, A Catholic Guide to the Moral Questions of Our Time. And today, we're talking about his book, How Science Points to God. Dr. Verschuren, thanks for joining me. It's good to have you again.
Thank you, Al, for inviting me on to be on your show.
Well, let's start with the whole scientific enterprise itself. It's been said by many historians of science that science rests upon assumptions that really emerge from a Christian understanding of life, the idea that there's a rational God who's created a rational universe, and creatures in his own image who can understand this. Talk to us about how science itself, the enterprise itself, is dependent upon our understanding of God.
Yes, as you said correctly, science has assumptions. Most scientists don't want to hear about that, so they ignore it. But you can't stay silent for the rest of your life about it.
Right.
So there must be something with those assumptions. In my book, I talk about at least five of them. One of them is that there is an objectively real world. Otherwise, science is just a matter of fiction if there is no real world.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is comprehensible.
Yes.
Even Albert Einstein said that. Otherwise, science would not be possible. If we cannot comprehend the world because it is chaos or we can't understand it, then there is no science possible. Mm-hmm. And also that our perception through eyes, ears, and hands is in essence reliable. Otherwise, science is not reliable.
Right.
And I think there is order in nature.
Mm-hmm.
The sun will rise every morning, though we may not always see it. It will arise. We don't have to be surprised every morning that the sun is there again. So science has to accept that. Science can prove quite a bit, but I'm very skeptical how much it can prove.
Mm-hmm.
But it can never prove its own assumptions. It has to assume them before science can even get off the ground.
Yes.
That is a clear indication, I would say, that it points to God. For where does that come from, that real world? Where do the laws of nature come from? Did they just pop up? That's hard to believe. That is magic.
Right.
And there is nothing magic in this world. So we have to say to everyone, and you talked in the beginning about the warfare, the lie, the myth, that there is a clash between science and religion. Well, we need that religion in order to let science even get started.
Exactly.
In the 15th, 16th century, almost all scientists were religious believers.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, when I tell people that I am a human geneticist and a believer, they look at me like, are you right? Is that possible? They see a conflict. And I keep saying there is no conflict. It's actually a very harmonious relationship. I sometimes call it a match made in heaven.
Yes.
We need religion in order to do science. Science can do a lot, but it cannot prove its own assumptions. That is a long answer to a short question.
No, very good. You write about the physical constants in our universe. What are these physical constants, and how do they point to God?
Oh, I find them very important and very powerful. We have four basic forces in nature: gravity, electromagnetism, weak nuclear interactions, and strong nuclear interactions. Where do those forces come from? If they were slightly different, I prove in my book that a lot of things in this world would be very different and some would not even be possible. If the strength of gravity, for instance, were not based on the inverse square of the distance, sorry for that technical language, then the orbits of the planets in the solar system would be much more complicated than ellipses, or circles, as some say, but it's really a matter of ellipses. And otherwise, our solar system would collapse, basically. So we need that gravity law. It's a law of nature. And the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force, as if they would have been a little different, the universe would have had a very different outcome. And probably we would not be on this Earth. There would not be human life. Of course, scientists say that's a matter of coincidence. And they come up with all kind of explanations, like Hawkins. He died not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was a famous astrophysicist. But he came up with a weird explanation. He said, there must have been multiple universes.
Yeah.
And one of them happens to be the one that we can live in.
Yeah.
Well, where does that idea come from? From Hawkins.
Right, right.
He found it out on his own. But there is no... How can you prove that there are multiple universes? That is impossible. You cannot step outside your own universe. He does so happily because he is a good physicist, but not a great philosopher. So I would rather refer to the Book of Wisdom that says, God, you have arranged all things by measure and number and weight. And the physical constants have been arranged by God according to that measure, to that number, and that weight. And that's why we can exist in this universe. Yeah. Again, that was a little bit technical, but your audience can handle that easily.
I'm sure. This, how unlikely is it that there would be a life-affirming universe or a life-possible universe? It's not very likely, right?
I don't find it very likely, and because it requires a lot of conditions.
Right.
And, and for those conditions to be found, Hawking would say, oh, yeah, find one in another planet, in another solar system or whatever. But why? Why do we need all of that?
Right.
We have to realize that everything on Earth is ruled by laws of nature. And those laws of nature, there we go again, where do they come from? They didn't just pop up. They came from God. And thanks to those laws of nature, certain things are possible and certain things are not possible. So we can say on this planet that there are certain laws that have to be fulfilled. So there must be something on this Earth that causes that. There is a famous periodic system that regulates everything from the from helium through uranium, all the 92 elements that we find on this world. That is a very strict system. Certain combinations of molecules are not possible. Certain compounds are not possible. And some are very likely, thanks to the periodic system. So I would say, when we go through, if I may jump to the issue of evolution, evolution was not just a haphazard event.
Right.
It works, as some say, with natural selection, whether you believe that or not. Even if you believe that, natural selection does not work haphazardly. It has to select what is successful. And things that are not really successful on this Earth will not make it in evolution. And so that's why I say that we have to follow those laws. A heart that does not follow hydrodynamic laws for pumping blood cannot be very successful. And, fish that don't follow hydrodynamic laws, or birds that don't follow laws of movement, they cannot be successful. So the path of evolution is not as weird as some people think. It follows, I always like to use that image, it follows a path of least resistance. Some things are very unlikely, have a high resistance, so the river cannot follow a path of high resistance. Water will never flow upwards.
Right.
So it has to follow the topographic design of the landscape, and so does the stream of evolution. It follows a path somehow regulated by the laws of nature and the design of the universe. Where does that design come from? You feel it coming.
Yeah.
From the Creator.
Right, right. Yeah.
He made everything possible. He designed the bed in which the stream of evolution meanders. So, is it random? Not really. And besides, randomness is something that we have to be very careful with. I always refer to Padre Pio, who always used to say, everyone who says that something is a matter of coincidence, I always ask, whom do you think regulated that coincidence?
Right, yes.
It's God.
Yes.
It's God. And even Thomas Aquinas, our famous philosopher in the Catholic Church,
He said, everyone who only believes in randomness, in chance, is not really a believer.
Yes.
So right. I always protest when I hear a scientist say, oh, that is randomness. But of course, they have the right to say that as a scientist. But as long as they don't claim that that's the final truth.
That's the final, that's right, that's the final controlling element. Dr. Bashirin, hold.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GETCURO.
The EWTN home video highlight for January is A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing 2, The Gender Agenda.
For two centuries, the ideologues of socialism or communism have used deceptive word jugglery to rebrand themselves as liberals or progressives.
Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
And so God looked at everything he had made and found it very good.
I suppose that includes what some biologists call junk DNA, what cosmologists call dark matter, what physicists suggest are hidden dimensions, or how time can distort space and gravity twist light. Atheists claim that science has the answers to everything. But in fact, as humans, when it comes to most of the universe, we have no idea. In our wisdom, we call the ubiquitous junk, dark, hidden, distorted, and twisted. Can the mysteries of the universe be all those things and still be very good? Impossible? We have no idea. But God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Do you ever just feel off, but you don't know why? Maybe everything seems fine, but you just feel down or disconnected. Well, you're in luck, because I've got just the thing to help you get your mood back on track. A new study by Texas A&M found that making small changes, like reminding yourself to smile more, can actually have a significant impact on your overall mood. Researchers caution that they don't mean to suggest that a person can smile their way to happiness, especially if someone is dealing with serious emotional problems. But they say the study is important because it highlights just how much our emotions take their cue from things like body posture or facial expressions. So go ahead. Give yourself permission to smile. It might be just what the doctor ordered. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Gerard Bashirin, author most recently of How Science Points to God. We've been looking at various aspects of the scientific enterprise, certain discoveries of science. And let's go to one which is relatively new in terms of discovery, the middle of the 20th century, the idea of the Big Bang. You've heard the idea that there's this Big Bang. You may even know that a Catholic priest had an essential role in helping to discover and confirm it. He was a Belgian priest, astronomer, and physicist, Father George Lemaître, at Catholic University of Louvain. When I was still in college, this hadn't been quite settled, at least according to my undergraduate physics teacher, who still thought there was something to be said for what used to be called the steady state theory of the universe. And Dr. Versharon, let me ask you, when was the Big Bang finally, when did it finally reach, become dominant in the minds of astrophysicists?
It, as you said, it's rather recent, but the weird thing is that the term Big Bang came from Fred Hoyle. He was a firm atheist, and he mocked at it by applying that name. It was not a compliment. He just said, oh, that's the Big Bang, because he was really a guy who believed in a steady state.
Right, right.
Where came that idea come from? Basically from Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, and he is not the first one in physics, he is a famous one, so I'm very careful to blame Einstein, but I have to. he came up with that eternal universe. He thought there was no beginning and no end. It had always been that way. Fortunately, Einstein was big enough to later say that was his biggest blunder he ever made. Mm-hmm. Because he finally had to face the fact that Edwin Hubble measured in 1929 that there was a cosmic expansion. I won't go into detail how he measured that, mm-hmm. but as long as we realize that there was a cosmic expansion, that means that the Earth had been a very tiny thing in space in the beginning, and it will expand and expand and expand. So he came up basically with that idea. But where came the idea from that this is expanding? Not from Fred Hoyle, not from Einstein, but from, as you said already, Father Lemaître. Mm-hmm. He was the priest from Belgium. So I'm a little biased. I'm from Holland, so I always feel close to him. He was teaching at the French-speaking part of the University of Leuven or Louvain, and he came up with the idea that there was something like a Big Bang. Again, that word was not his; that came later from Fred Hoyle. So, actually, Albert Einstein was horrified when he heard that. He said, this is unbelievable. There is no way that can be true. But, as I said already, he finally said, I made a big mistake. Father Lemaître was right. And so I have to say, and we have to be honest about everything, in 2018, the members of the International Astronomical Union voted overwhelmingly to recommend that the famous Hubble law of Edwin Hubble in 1929 that described the expansion of the universe would from now on be called the Hubble-Lemaître law.
Huh.
Ooh, wow. That is quite a compliment for Father Lemaître, Catholic, a priest. I'd like to quote one of his sayings where he says, I have no conflict to reconcile. You talked about the conflict before.
Yeah.
Science has not shaken my faith in religion, and religion has never caused me to question the conclusions I reached by scientific methods.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the end of the warfare myth, the end of the conflict theory. I hope you agree.
Yes, I was a real, again, when I was an undergraduate, there was still talk of it, but, in recent years, it seems to me, those who try to maintain this idea of a conflict between science and religion are not themselves historians of science. They're novelists, filmmakers, popular speakers, and there are a few adamant atheists who, for personal reasons, like to drive a wedge between science and faith, but serious historians of science just don't do that.
No, but those atheists like to keep the conflict myth going and going and going.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you were talking about teachers, professors, and stuff like that. Many of them have never gotten that far yet. They are good scientists, but they never learned how to philosophize on it and how to see that there is a deeper dimension to life than that. So they keep, as I always say, they keep portraying that myth, and unfortunately, students are the victims.
You work in the field of genetics. Tell us a little bit about how genetics points to God. We also have an important Catholic figure in the history of genetics, too, with Gregor Mendel. But go ahead and tell us how genetics points to God.
Yeah, they call Mendel always the father of genetics. He was one of the first ones who worked with that kind of approach. And, again, a priest, a monk. I don't really think he was a priest, but
I think he was
an Augustinian monk.
That's right. I think you're right. Right.
Yeah, so he started the whole thing, and since then, things have taken off quite a bit. It took 50 years before genetics really started to blossom, with genes, alleles, chromosomes, and stuff like that. But it is basically since 1953 that genetics really took off, because at that time, the DNA molecule was unraveled.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA molecule has often been called the secret of life. Well, DNA is not a secret of life. DNA can't do anything on itself. If you put DNA in a test tube, it can't do anything.
Yeah.
It's like a dead piece of text that needs to be read and to make sense. A virus, and we are talking about viruses all the time nowadays, a virus even is not alive. It is a DNA or RNA molecule in a protein code. A code.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs a cell to go into. So viruses go into human cells, for instance, in the case of the China virus.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it goes into a bacteria or whatever. So they need the machinery of life, of a cell. So I would say the cell is the secret of DNA. DNA is not the secret of life.
Mm-hmm.
But still, DNA is powerful. It regulates the proteins we make in our body, and we all need proteins. Enzymes are proteins. So you cannot metabolize things if you don't have the right proteins. So that's why I can see that people say DNA is an important molecule. Yes, yes, yes. But it needs much more than DNA. It needs everything around it. So some have called DNA, it is a language of information.
Mm-hmm.
And information is not a chemical concept. There is no information in the molecule, basically. But DNA does have information. So where does that information come from?
Yeah.
The famous man who was in charge of the genome project, Collins, Francis Collins,
mm-hmm.
he was a very dedicated Christian. He was so Christian that when he was going to be assigned to that project, a lot of people protested, as they are doing now with a new chief justice, a potential chief justice. They say, how can a Christian, or let alone a Catholic, how can they be doing something for the government? Well, Francis Collins did. So he said, we have a code of God. It's the language of God, as he called it. And one of his books has that title.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice to read. I recommend it highly. I refer to it in my book, The Pointers to God, Science Points to God. It points to God each time we have a new generation coming. We don't have to start everything from scratch, nor does God have to start everything from scratch. He uses the information of the DNA code to get us started. And so where does the DNA code come from? From previous DNA? Yes. But it's also coming from God. Is that a conflict? Of course not.
Right.
God uses the DNA code just as he uses the laws of nature to make things happen in this world. So I always say children come through the laws of genetics and of DNA from their parents. But ultimately, they come from God. It doesn't make sense to create a conflict there. If I say they come from parents, that does not mean they cannot come from God. No. There is no conflict. There is no warfare there. It would be a conflict if I say they come from parents or they come from the stork. That's a conflict.
Right.
Either one is true. No, there is only one true. But you can come from parents and you can come from God. It is through the parents that God creates new human beings.
I want to return. I'm sorry, go right ahead.
Yeah, made in the image of God, as the book of Genesis says.
Yes.
We are all made in his image.
I want to go back to something you said earlier when you were talking about evolution, and that is this idea of randomness, which some people think of as pure chance. When it looks as though natural selection operates according to randomness, random according to who? In other words, doesn't the idea of randomness have a technical meaning in evolutionary studies? It doesn't mean the same kind of randomness that would displace God. Because some people think of randomness, they think of, well, if it's random, it means God can have nothing to do with it. If it's pure chance, God can have nothing to do with it.
Correct, yeah. That's what they think.
Yeah.
But there is a big difference. You are right in saying that. So what I would like to just mention very briefly that Thomas Aquinas speaks of two kind of causes. The secondary causes are the causes we know from science. That is how molecules create new molecules, how DNA creates new DNA, etc. But there is all those causes can't do anything if there is no first cause. Well, randomness in science is a term that is very, very correct, very scientific. And it says something about how secondary causes cause other causes that can sometimes be random. Even Thomas Aquinas says that there is chance in nature.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also randomness that some people use as the ultimate ruler of life and of this universe. But then they are replacing God with a new deity.
That's right.
The deity of randomness, of chance. I always say that is chance with a capital C. Well, there is no chance with a capital C. Chance is just a scientific concept. And as Stephen Barr, who is a particle physicist, mm-hmm. I borrowed from him the important distinction. You could say I stole it from him, but I rather say I borrowed it from him. He said, randomness in science is how secondary causes cause each other. Mm-hmm. That can be random.
Yes.
But the randomness that some people talk about is about how are things related to God. And God is the ruler of everything. In the eyes of God, nothing is random.
Right.
God is all-knowing, all-present. He knows what is going to happen and what has happened. So there is nothing random in that sense.
Very good.
The people who confuse those two are basically making a big philosophical...
Dr. Verschuren, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Once again, great talking with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
If I disciplined consistently, I'd be disciplining constantly. If I were consistent in my discipline, that would mean I would discipline more, and I'd be disciplining him often. The exact opposite is the case. More consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. Why? Because you're predictable. The child knows if he does A, you'll do B. That is why, when you are predictable in your authority, you will actually have to use that authority less. Consistent discipline leads to less constant discipline. The more you act when you need to act, the less you will have to act in the future with similar misbehavior.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for being here. Now, coming up next hour, I'm going to return to the president's inauguration today. I'm not going to comment much on it. But I do want to point out that in the first century, Catholics had a lot to deal with, more than we have to deal with. How did they deal with it? We'll find out.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
And good afternoon. Thanks for being with me. We've got another hour in front of us talking about the things that matter most. In this hour, we are going to take time to hear the story of Cynthia Skodova, raised fundamentalist, during the 60s and 70s, teenage years, well, then she becomes more of a pagan, involved in nature mysticism, Eastern philosophies. After a while, she finds herself fully embracing the spirituality of the liberal movements of the 70s and 80s. She was drinking from lots of different troughs here. She did eventually marry, and though she starts out not wanting kids, it was her first child that began her journey into full communion with the Catholic Church. She'll be joining us a little later in this hour. I want to take some time today to also reflect on the inauguration. We now have a President Biden and Vice President Harris. And I know this is going to be a source of frustration, irritation for many of us, and it's perfectly understandable. I do want to point out, though, I've got a few words I want to share on this before, a little bit after the news, but it really comes down to this. Look, Catholics in the first century had more to deal with than we do. They were a persecuted minority. We're harassed, but not really persecuted. In America, we're more harassed than we are persecuted. So how did they deal with the threat? They had to deal with Nero, right? We're dealing with, you know, an administration that has championing abortion rights, that may not have the same appreciation of religious liberty that we're accustomed to. Now, I don't know if that's going to be a problem or not. During the Obama administration, Biden was actually one of the members of that administration that was a little more sensitive to the religious liberty issue. So we'll see. But he's changed in the last few years. But how, if you got the neuronic persecution going on, where do you find consolation? And if they found consolation there, I'm sure we can. But right now, let's get to the news.
Thanks, Al, and good afternoon. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Matthew Handley. It's Wednesday, January 20th, the Feast of St. Sebastian. The news this hour is sponsored by the Ave Maria Family of Funds. More info at AveMariaFunds.com. Hours after he was inaugurated the 46th President of the United States, Joe Biden laid a wreath this afternoon at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier with former Presidents Obama, Bush, and Clinton. Pope Francis issued a blessing on Biden and the American people today as well. While across the nation security was stepped up in a visible way, there's little to report in terms of staged protests on this inauguration day. After this month's storming of the Capitol and reports of FBI memos warning of potentially armed protests, security was increased at federal buildings and state capitals. There was one lone Trump supporter who showed up outside the State House in Albany, New York. A man protested outside the Vermont State Capitol. And in D.C., one man held a pro-Trump protest. The Department of Justice has closed its investigation into North Carolina Senator Richard Burr. Sarah Bartlett has the story.
The Republican will not be charged in connection with a controversial stock trade. It was alleged that Burr sold more than $1.5 million in stocks last February after receiving insider information about the possible economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. Several other senators were also investigated for similar incidents at the time, but those cases have already been closed. Sarah Bartlett, NBC News Radio.
And in the Central African Republic, increased armed violence is hampering the delivery of vital aid and commercial goods, according to the UN's humanitarian coordinator in the country. Denise Brown expressed extreme concern over sustained disruptions on the main supply road, which connects the capital Bangui with the rest of the country and with the closest port in neighboring Cameroon. Violence has escalated in the CAR surrounding elections held in late December, forcing more than 120,000 to flee their homes. UN peacekeepers have also been killed in the attacks. With your Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Matthew Handley.
Taking every thought captive to Christ. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon.
Well, good afternoon to you. I was saying before the news break that Catholics in the first century really had more to deal with than we do. Of course, they were living in a pre-Christian society. We live in a post-Christian society. There's different issues with each. But scriptures are given to us for our own edification, both the Old and the New Testaments. We are supposed to draw from them. And if Catholics in the first century had to deal with Nero, they're dealing with a man who will persecute, not just harass, but persecute the church. And judging by, reading the New Testament, you get the impression that they didn't really focus much on Nero because that would distract them. It'd distract them from their mission. And their mission was to create a community that bore witness to Christ and his kingdom. I'm sure they were aware of what was going on, in the Roman Empire. But in our case, if a Biden administration clamps down on freedom of religion, for instance, we're going to be aware of it, and we'll see what happens. But I don't want to spend the next 4 years having my attention fixated on him or on the political world. Being aware is one thing. Perpetually taking his temperature and chasing down this or that suspicion to see how much danger we're in really can get us off base spiritually. Leads to all kinds of nasty habits of fear, projection, conspiracy, suspicion. And it's very clear from, again, the New Testament that even in an age where you had Nero, you were not supposed to be living in fear of the Roman Empire. How much less should we be living in fear of what's going on today? During Advent, it's very common, of course, to read from the Book of Revelation. And I want to go to a sermon that I came across by Ian Boxall that takes a look at Revelation chapter 21, which I do think has much to offer to us. So Revelation 21, what you see, of course, is the New Jerusalem. Behind, in the early church saw in these visionary experiences, by the way, they saw the truth behind their political realities. So, then I saw a new heaven, this is John, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So this is Revelation chapter 21. It's talking about, of course, the coming of Christ, bringing about a new heaven and a new earth. And we need to be particularly careful here because John's vision is often read, especially in Protestant circles, evangelical Protestant circles, is rarely read as if we're somehow waiting for the total destruction of our old world, including all those things that we do hold dear, the places we hold dear, the relationships that we hold dear. The impression you get from some of these end-time scenarios that anything that's old and familiar is going to be burned away and is so rotten to the core that it needs to be destroyed to make way for some kind of shiny new spiritual replacement. And there are millions of Christians in today's world who think this is precisely what John is seeing here. God is at work slowly but surely masterminding the countdown towards the earth's, what, nuclear destruction? You know, some sort of environmental catastrophe? But basically, they're expecting to see the earth turned into, in its last stages, kind of a map of, you know, the Middle East, and that's going to be where all the action is. Look, that's not the impression you get from reading the Book of Revelation, which, in fact, was given to the churches to deal with these difficult times. That's not what John sees. John sees a God who's intended on renewing his creation, not destroying it. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And a God who obliterates the old in favor of some brand new replacement is not the God who makes all things new. I mean, the fathers of the church read John's vision very differently from a lot of these end-time preachers today. Saint Andreas of Caesarea, for instance, and reputed to be the most astute Greek commentator on the Book of Revelation, puts it like this way. He says, quote, "It does not mean non-existence of creation, but a renewal for the better. What we're waiting for is the renewal of that which we know into something even more glorious rather than its obliteration." So what John is seeing is creation purged, you know, by the searing light of Christ's judgment, purged of sin and destructive tendencies, so totally judged, so fully purged of what frustrates God's will, that even the most fundamental sign of the separation between God and God's creation, the distinction between heaven and earth, that distinction is now done away with. The tabernacle of God is among mortals. That's the degree of purification we're going to see in this, quote, new creation. God is fully at one with his people. And this utter renewal of creation includes, of course, our own transformation into the people God created us to be, a people more glorious, more fully human, more open to God, more transparent to the divine light, so that we are purged of any lingering fear that the coming of Christ might mean to us. I mean, a lot of people grow up fearing the return of Jesus. The blessed hope. It's the blessed fear. You know, he's going to come back and spank us. Look, the coming of Jesus means the coming of the perfection of God's creation. John also sees here that the New Jerusalem is, you know, not kind of like just a suburb of the old. It's it's not a brand new replacement. It's the renewed Jerusalem. It's Jerusalem transformed, but it's still Jerusalem. Just like our bodies are not going to be entirely new bodies. They're glorified bodies. Will be recognizable. So same thing with Jerusalem. It's a renewed Jerusalem, a transformed Jerusalem, but it's still Jerusalem. And I find that reassuring, given that, you know, all of us can probably identify specific places which have been particularly important in our lives, places of pilgrimage, places we call home, places where you've had significant life experiences. And John's vision points to the possibility of those places being caught up and renewed in the new heaven and the new earth. Remember, it's our life which is redeemed. And that's the life we've been living. But it's going to be purged of, you know, disordered self-love. It's going to be purged of sin. But the New Jerusalem is not simply a place. This is another important point. It's a city. In the ultimate vision, we don't go back to the Garden of Eden. In this ultimate vision in Revelation 21, John is seeing the fulfillment of God's plan as a city, because that's where human beings cooperate. That's where you see human culture. You see human aspirations being fulfilled. True, this is the Jerusalem that God builds, but in building the New Jerusalem, God is taking up and transfiguring all our human longings and all our human desires to participate in this creativity. In fact, in the book of Revelation, the kings of the earth bring all their works of culture into the New Jerusalem. So it's not just going back to the garden, it's coming into a city. Finally, John's vision gives us a hint that the New Jerusalem is not only something that we're waiting for with anticipation in the future. We are certainly doing that. I think it's one of the things that's been lost on many 21st century Christians is the idea of the blessed hope that we expect the return of Christ. We expect the new heavens and the new earth. We expect the heavenly Jerusalem. But St. Augustine in the City of God makes an important point. We're not just waiting for it to happen at the end of time. In the City of God, Book 20, he picks up on John's phrase that the New Jerusalem is, quote, coming down. The New Jerusalem does not simply come down at the end, but is already coming down out of heaven from God, even during our historical process. In other words, in our time right now, the heavenly Jerusalem is coming down. That's one of the reasons why the architects of the medieval cathedrals were so keen to model them on John's description of the New Jerusalem. We have all these intermediate comings of Christ. For instance, the Eucharist is a coming of Christ. So when he comes again in full glory, he's coming not to destroy that which he created, but to renew it. And I bring this up because Christians in the first century, when they saw the coming of the heavenly Jerusalem, they saw that God was indeed blessing their experience in this world as they bore witness to that coming kingdom. It's like he's saying to us, bear witness to what is coming. It is coming. It's on the way. You're not just waiting for the end, for some, nuclear blast or for some, environmental catastrophe. No, you are right now bearing witness to a coming kingdom. And, I just think what our communities and our lives would be like, all of us, if we really were able to keep in our mind's eye a vision of this new Jerusalem that's already descending, already renewing, already transforming us, our parishes, our families, into the likeness of Christ. And, so far as we know, we're going to be enduring tribulation in this world. We're going to have suffering. It's our lot, right now, to a more or less degree. But when we look at the heavenly Jerusalem, what's coming down, it's a city. We don't bear these sufferings alone. We bear them as citizens of a new world. It's coming down. The kingdom has begun. It's on its way. We seek it first. We meet it. Might say we meet it halfway. We seek first the kingdom, and all these other concerns that we have, those will be added. I'm Al Cresta.
Who is responsible for the death of Jesus? The Catholic Catechism emphatically states that neither the Jews of Jesus' time nor the Jews of our time should be considered rejected or accursed as a consequence of the Lord's Passion. Not all the Jews in the religious hierarchy were opposed to him. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea were two prominent men who were secret disciples. The Acts of the Apostles notes that many priests were obedient to the faith, and some belonged to the party of the Pharisees. St. James reported to St. Paul that many thousands believed in the Lord and were also zealous for the law. The religious authorities were not in unanimity as to what to do with Jesus. The Pharisees threatened excommunication to his followers. The Sanhedrin, having declared him a blasphemer, but without power to execute, turned him over to the Romans as a political anarchist. The Catechism cautions we must leave judgment as to the participants in Jesus' trial to God alone. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire his blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
We just did our parish mission a couple weeks ago now, and I suggested that in the course of the mission that we do something like a little mini spiritual assessment of our lives. I don't have to show this to anybody, but a great chance for us just to, with real honesty, just between us and Jesus, ask ourselves some questions. First question, given the fact that half of Catholics don't think God is even personal, would be to ask ourselves that. Do I think God is personal? And then to ask myself, do I think a relationship with Jesus is possible? Do I have a relationship with Jesus? And if so, what's it look like? And then perhaps a little bit more awkwardly or painfully, to ask Jesus, from his perspective, what's the friendship that we have with him look like? How would he describe our friendship with him? That might be a hard conversation to have.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. It's always good to hear stories of how people are drawn into full communion. It's always good to hear how they come to an encounter with Jesus and then drawn into full communion with his church. My guest Cynthia Skadova was raised in a fundamentalist branch of Protestant Christianity during the 60s and 70s, and as a teenager, she was drawn toward nature mysticism and Eastern philosophies, and a few years later, she found herself fully embracing the spirituality of the liberal movements of the 70s and 80s. She did eventually marry, though she didn't want kids, but it was with her first child that began her journey to the Catholic Church. She joined us now. She works as a neuromuscular therapist with a background in fine and language arts. In fact, served as a high school teacher for a while. Also a horse farmer and a monk in progress. She blogs at The Mad-Eyed Monk. That's madeyedmonk.blogspot.com. Cynthia, great to make your acquaintance.
Great to be here. It's an honor. I'm an admirer of your work.
Oh, thank you. Well, you'll find this interesting. When I first realized that the Jesus of the New Testament was not what we now call the Jesus of the New Age movement, the first church I went to was Grace Brethren Church in Lansing, Michigan, associated with the Grace Brethren denomination from Winona Lake. That's where you grew up, is that right?
I grew up in the Grace Brethren Church, yes,
yeah,
in Mansfield, Ohio. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't stay there long, but that was my first contact with historic, you know, any historic form of Christianity. I was raised Catholic and then fell away. So we're looking at a long time ago, 1974, 75, when I was there. But so did you take your faith seriously when you were growing up?
I did when I was a child. And, you know, I mean, I'm grateful for a lot that I did learn there. I mean, we learned a lot of Bible stories, had to memorize a lot of passages. So it was a good education, you know, growing up,
mm-hmm.
Until I got into my teen years,
yeah.
And I fell away rather quickly.
What were the issues that presented themselves as insurmountable temptations at the time?
Well, a lot of it was a rebellious nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was a rebellious teenager, and I didn't embrace a lot of the strict orthodoxy of that particular branch of
yeah.
Christianity,
yeah.
And I really kind of fell into the, you know, Eastern religions and philosophies of
yeah.
the time, and that kind of took me farther away from Christianity.
Where were you first exposed to those? Where were you first exposed to those Eastern philosophies?
Actually, it all began with the Tao Te Ching book I happened to see and acquire, and then I was very much into writing poetry and the art, so
okay.
It just spoke to me. And then, you know, I proceeded from there to investigate and read. And then went off to college at Ohio State and was more of being indoctrinated into liberalism, and the women's movement was really just getting a foothold
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
And I embraced a lot of the liberal ideologies and women's movement propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
I took the first women's studies class that they offered there.
Really?
And,
wow.
Yeah. And just really... started railing against patriarchy, and then that included, of course, any religion, because I looked at religion as patriarchal. And
right. So, did you become an atheist?
I did. Yes, I did. I was an atheist for a while. Just really was into more agnosticism with the life force that runs through
yeah.
everything.
Okay.
You know, kind of the nature. I love nature, so that spoke to me. Read a lot of, you know, the early American transcendentalists.
Yeah.
You know, Thoreau, Emerson.
Did you read Annie Dillard around that time?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Read all of Annie Dillard.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's kind of... And there was a lot of beauty, and there were good things to glean from all that.
Sure.
You know, but it just kind of fueled my journey away from Christ, basically.
Yeah, yeah. How did you regard the Catholic Church as an institution back then?
Oh, I really did not like the Catholic Church at all. I railed against the Catholic Church a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they did, because of the male priest and, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the fact that I became Catholic is astounding. It's still astounding to me when I look back where
now,
I was.
When you met your husband, was he sharing the same, you know, ideologies that you were sharing?
He was he shared a lot of my liberalism. He did not, he still believed in God. He was a fallen away Catholic.
Okay.
So, you know, that was fine with me, you know, at that time. So yeah, we were along the same page. He did not embrace my feminism, my radical feminism. He would roll his eyes a lot at things I would say.
Okay.
Believe. But he hung in there.
Yeah. So once you're married, what's your attitude towards children?
I really did not want to ever be married in my 20s or have children because I thought that was diminishing my womanhood.
Yeah.
And that marriage was like a private tyrannical state, in other words, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, you know, my husband is the one who really convinced me to have children, actually. You know, he brought forth, the beauty of having a child to me in a way that, you know, it just made me stop and look at it differently. I guess it broke through a lot of my propagandized mentality at the time, you know. And as I was just beginning to, you know, see how, you know, having a child would be a beautiful thing to do, is when I became pregnant. So, yeah.
The timing was right.
it was, absolutely. Yeah.
And what was the experience? I mean, pregnancy can be a very difficult time for some women. Other women seem to thrive during pregnancy. What kind of pregnancy did you have? Was it tough?
It was very tough,
yeah.
Yes. I was one of those women that was sick all day, day for 4 straight months. And then it wasn't so bad after that. But, yeah, my best friend committed suicide during that. So, yeah, that was, she was like my sister. And so that made the pregnancy extra hard.
Oh, my word.
Know? Yeah, it was a very difficult time because I had this extreme joy of bringing this child into the world and then this extreme grief happening at the same time.
Which is a very, here you are in a life-affirming posture.
Right.
And yet you have a very close friend who's basically denying that life is worth living.
Right.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's such a tragic dichotomy there.
Wow. Yeah. Did you dwell on it at all?
Yeah, it was difficult. I actually, even went to counseling for it because, you know, I couldn't breathe. And I was trying to get my breath back.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a very difficult time. But then there was this joy, you know, of this child coming. So it was just this one extreme to the other constantly, you know. So it was an interesting first pregnancy.
So were you, as you came more and more to embrace the idea of motherhood and the fact of your maternity, did you find your attitude towards theistic religions changing at all?
No.
Okay.
I did not. It wasn't until later when my son was entering into school. I mean, I was still, I really embraced a lot of the New Age writers and Wayne Dyer, Eckhart Tolle, you know, the list goes on. I was really steeped in that. It wasn't until my son started kindergarten and our public school wasn't very good where we were living. So I wanted to send him to the Catholic school. And in order to send him there, I told my husband he had to join the church so we could get the hefty discount for him going
sure.
there. And so he did. He went, you know, back, but then, you know, he had a reconversion and really started attending Mass and all the sacraments. And then I was in another dilemma because I remember talking to my sister and saying, I'm married to a man who goes to Mass. What am I going to do? Like, I was at that point then, you know.
Yeah.
So then, you know, my son was at a Catholic school and going to Mass with my husband. And then he kept asking me to go to Mass with them. And I said, okay, you know, I can sit in this beautiful church and listen to this beautiful music. And that's when things began to happen, you know. The real presence of Christ in the Eucharist was working on me there.
Wow.
Even as I sat in the pew and, you know.
Now,
of course.
How were you raising your child? I mean, what were you teaching? What stories were you telling your child at that time?
Oh, I was teaching him all about world religions, reading him Siddhartha Gautama's story and a lot of, you know, just nature mysticism, you know, stories that were full of beauty and love and, you know, but I did not teach him anything about Christianity at that point.
You're at Mass, and the Eucharist begins working on you. When, I'm just curious, what was it? You were there, you were settled in a beautiful church, you heard the music, you saw the people going up for communion. What did you think was happening?
I think it was Christ just coming within me. I felt him.
Mm-hmm.
It was experiential, not so much intellectual, because my intellect was my worst enemy and blocked a lot of, you know, Christ trying to reach me, you know. But sitting at Mass and, you know, I think he was able to, you know, break through the intellectualism, and actually I could experience his presence in that church.
Hold it there, if you would, Cynthia. Got to take a break and come back. And again, this experience of the presence of Christ, again, gets underneath the defenses that are often erected intellectually. We'll come back and continue your conversation.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual fund. You can learn more about the Ave Maria mutual funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com. This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Over the last 50 years, we've had some of the greatest popes since the Reformation era. So why are things such a mess in American Catholicism? How do we analyze and confront the attacks we're facing? How do we identify wolves in sheep's clothing? How do we re-evangelize the baptized? Dr. Ralph Martin makes sense of a church in crisis and shows pathways forward. He'll make sense of a disordered world. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and you'll find it in our online bookstore.
I didn't take my faith seriously, which probably means I never really got it to begin with. No, I didn't want to give up sin. The reason we sin is because sin is fun. But it's self-love sin. But it's amazing with God's grace how easy trying to not sin it really is.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for whatever reason, we invite you to take another look. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
Welcome to Spirit of Stewardship. Jeremy Belsky is your host for real-life stories, encouragement, and ideas to enhance your own gifts of work, wealth, and wisdom in response to God's blessings for you.
I'm Jeremy Belsky, and today's topic is
stewardship of the environment, God's creation of nature. When you hear the message, be a wise steward of your resources, do you ever consider the role you play in your community environment? It's natural to think of time, talent, and treasure when stewardship is mentioned, but our faith teaches us that all is a gift from God. Thus, respect for nature and doing our part to ensure a safe and clean environment is important. Here are just three areas we can pay more attention. A lot of action has been taken in recent years by nonprofits geared towards a cleaner environment. The first area of focus is to eliminate litter. Consider how your actions to pick up after yourself are pleasing to God. Be proud to do your part to keep your community and neighborhood clean. Secondly, look at ways to recycle and make the most out of your purchases. Does it matter to you that so much plastic consumes our landfills? Have you given thought as to how you can make a particular purchase last longer? Third, in a country filled with abundance, what's being done to ensure our nature and environment for the next generation? This is more than eating bread crust and cleaning off your plate. The root lies in not wasting what we've been given. There's a great deal of time and effort that goes into caring for our place of residence in addition to our possessions. Keeping up what is ours or giving our used possessions to the less fortunate are a couple of ways to be prudent stewards of our blessings from God. I'm Jeremy Belsky, your host for Spirit of Stewardship.
To learn how you can better share your talents and resources, contact your local parish priest. Your level of involvement in the church now positively impacts our faith in the future.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Cynthia Skadova. She is recounting her coming into full communion with the Catholic Church. And again, a fascinating story. By the way, she blogs at The Mad Eyed Monk. So you just head over there, Mad Eyed Monk, one word, .blogspot.com/. So the presence of Christ starts asserting himself. What's the first thing you want to do at that point? Do you want to go read a Bible? Do you want to go talk to the priest? Did you want to ask your husband to straighten this out? What did you do when you began to feel some sense of reality there?
I really wanted to receive him in the Eucharist.
Okay.
You know, above and beyond anything, it was such a peace and joy.
Yeah.
That, you know, I really wanted to receive him in the Eucharist, and I couldn't because I wasn't Catholic, and that started prompting my desire to investigate Catholicism,
mm-hmm.
because I really never did
right.
fully. You know, I just took it up the surface. And so I started reading all the church fathers and saints' writings, and, you know, that started me down that path. And then I joined RCIA and continued mm-hmm. my conversion and to join the church.
You were part of, early on, you were in the women's movement and one of the first women's studies students at Ohio State. Where was abortion? I mean, I remember a conversation I had with Gloria Steinem years ago where she said abortion is the sine qua non of the women's movement. So abortion and the women's movement seem to go hand in hand. What was your attitude Absolutely. Towards abortion now that you were a mother?
Even when I was a mother, I still did not let go of that a woman has the right to choose. Even though when I saw the ultrasound of my son in the womb, that's when I really started to realize the lies of the women's movement. You know, it was like, this is a child. It's not a bunch of cells. But I still didn't relinquish that pseudo power, in a sense, that mm-hmm. women should have the right to choose. But it absolutely goes hand in hand with the women's movement. And I embraced that. I mean, I was witness to the women's movement and the destruction of a lot that is sacred, really.
Yeah.
In the process of that. I mean, I'm not saying that there wasn't good that came out of it, but it got hijacked
mm-hmm.
by, you know, far left radical, and it got hijacked by darkness.
Right.
And it left women in the most vulnerable positions where they, you know, a lot of college women, they were having abortion and not thinking twice about it, in a sense. Maybe that was on the surface. I don't know what their inner life was or, you know, but it was, we had that right. We were going after careers, and, you know, we had the right to not, you know, bring a child into the world. So it wasn't an ideology that embraced the right of the child in the womb, because the child in essence didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It was just a bunch of cells.
So
and even, you know, go ahead.
So you still, even after you saw your child, you were still able to, I mean, would you just say to yourself, well, it's a clump of cells, but if the mother wants to keep the child, that kind of endows that bunch of cells with personhood?
Yeah, well, even, you know, seeing that it was a child, I still, with my intellectual part of my being, was like, well, the woman still has that right to choose.
Yeah,
And it comes out of that whole new age. It's like trying to make ourselves into little gods,
mm-hmm.
you know. And a lot of that is steeped in the secular universities, you know, that ideology and philosophy that, you know, we are our own gods,
yep.
you know, in a sense. So that still had a stronghold in me. And, you know, as, you know, I gave birth to my son and, you know, I started shifting, but it took me a few years to shift all the way
yeah.
to see through the lies and see through, you know, how destructive a lot of the women, the radical feminist ideology was.
Yeah, yeah.
And is. You know, it's gotten worse since, you know, I was, you know, since the 80s,
yes.
and 90s.
Yes.
It's actually boring, you know. I mean, it's and horrific in a lot of ways, you know. It's very full of darkness you know, it was quite enlightening. And, you know, the more, you know, I was growing in my faith, you know, the more I could see, you know, a lot of the error of the women's movement, you know, a lot of error of women trying to, instead of being strong women who were daughters of the creator of the universe, you know, they're trying to make themselves into men. And, you know, it's like, if we look to Mary, you know, we see, you know, the most powerful woman, and she's the most powerful woman because she said yes to God. She humbled herself.
Right.
So, you know, and I remember when I was joining the church, someone asked me, well, how can you join the church when only men can be priests? You have no powers and that. And I remember, and this could only have come from God because I wasn't smart enough to think this, but it was like, it's not about power. And that's what helped me overcome those obstacles that had been entrenched in me from the women's movement. It's not about power. But then, in essence, if we open ourselves to be a conduit of God's grace working through us, that's real power because it's God's power, not ours. We're not little gods. So that insight really helped me along my conversion.
That's fascinating. I mean, and that's one of those life-changing realizations, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. That human wisdom doesn't get us what we want, but there is something called the divine wisdom. Human striving doesn't get us what we want, but there is something called divine power. But we can't receive that until we submit.
Right. Right. I mean, God asks for our humility above all else.
Right.
You know, so much of secular thought is contrary to that. And, you know, it's not fulfilling. It doesn't, you know, fill that void within us. And,
right.
you know, so it's the joy and the love and the light, you know, that I've enjoyed, you know, journeying toward, you
mm-hmm.
know. And as I, you know, unfold more of the mysteries of faith, it's even more beautiful. It's like looking at a multifaceted jewel,
yeah.
you know, it just becomes even more beautiful as you go along. And I think those are the glimpses of Christ, you know, that you're looking at. So, you know, where else would I want to be? I know, you know, even with the recent, you know, sex abuse
yep.
scandal that's been happening, it's, I had a priest friend of mine ask me, you know, so how has that affected your faith? And I'm like, well, you know, I have to say, like Peter, you know, St. Peter, you know, it's like, where else would I go?
Exactly.
Where else would I turn to? I've come down this really difficult, you know, road full of my own, you know, stumbling. And
mm-hmm.
to arrive here, it's like I have no desire to go anywhere else.
Right.
You know, I've already searched long and hard, and you know, so it's Christ in the Eucharist once again. It's His church. You know, yes, it's full of fallen humanity, but it's His church.
Yeah.
And yes, we need to, you know, keep reforming and weed out, you know, evil.
Yeah.
But it's still Christ Church, and it's worth fighting for.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, this is how does this affect your marriage? I'm just curious because your husband was kind of got involved in the church before you did. And it sounds like your son also was coming into belief before you were received into full communion. Was that a smooth transition as you became more and more Catholic?
Well, it certainly helped as I became more and more Catholic, as opposed to the beginning, you know. But, yeah, it did. I mean, and I could tell my son was really happy with me coming to Mass, and that's what kept me going, you know. I wanted to make him happy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was bumpy, but it got better. And then, you know, when my husband wanted to be, you know, married, because we were married in a universalist Unitarian church and by a Presbyterian minister, and so we were married in the Catholic Church then by a priest, and I went along with that for him, you know. But I'm glad I did now.
Yes.
What do you do? Do you still have friends from the women's movement days that you talk with?
Yes, I do. I do. Yes.
How do they account for your changed life?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they respect me. They respect as far as, you know, they're not hostile to it, but they can't understand how on earth I could be Catholic and a woman. But the only thing I can really do is, you know, express the joy and beauty of Catholicism when I do talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how I see things, and you know, and it's you know, I'm not railing against them, but I'm just putting forward the beauty, and it causes pause. I can tell, you know. So
that's
I'm
good.
Hoping, you know, there are little seeds, you know, that are being planted in that, you know, and just like I'm working on a memoir right now, and,
good.
You know, with hopes of, you know, helping the walking wounded out
right.
there, you know, and that, you know, women who have gone through this or who are still steeped in that kind of darkness, maybe, you know, like reaching out a hand to try and pull them into the light from
sure.
that is kind of my purpose of it, and, you know, pull them towards Christ in that. So, it's an ongoing. It's, you know, as a neuromuscular therapist, I deal with people in pain, and I tend to that, and I try to help them out of it. So in a way, this is more of that, only on a spiritual level.
Sure.
So it's kind of what I want to do with my middle years here.
Yeah. Well, I think
willing.
Your experience of being, of the Eucharist drawing you, is fascinating. This is an aspect of the faith that I don't think we respect enough, and that is that the power of God is at work there, even beyond our imaginings and beyond our thinking and our beyond our ability to articulate it. Something is going
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. And I can only say, and this, the most powerful thing about that was it was the presence of Christ. It was like it was like a person. It wasn't, you know, people like it's the life force. No,
right.
It was like it's a difference. I was into the life force. I know what that is.
That's right.
But this was like the person of Christ. I mean, it was so powerful. It's like I had no intellectual guard to that. Yeah, because it was experiential, and, you know, intellectually I would have rejected it, this and that, but it was just that powerful.
Wow.
And that's what drew me down that path.
Yeah.
That I never thought in a million years I would go.
Cynthia, it's a beautiful story. I'm anxious to hear the memoir or to read it when it comes out. I hope
you
get it done, and we'll talk again, okay?
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, likewise. Cynthia Skudova, the book, her book will be out. Right now you can follow her work at The Mad Eyed Monk. That's madeyedmonk.blogspot.com. I'm Al Cresta.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
There is a time for everything under heaven.
As moral agents, we exist in a universe that allows us to move in three space and one time dimensions called space-time. The paradox in which God has placed us allows us complete freedom of movement through the space dimensions, but we are constrained to move in only one direction through time. That irony of freedom and constraint forces upon us the natural law of causation. For every moral action we take in space, a moral consequence is delivered in time. In space, we can go forward or backward. But why, oh why, can't we go back in time and fix things? We really have no idea, but God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
To vent or not? If I get it off my chest, then I feel better. I've got to vent. Is this so? It's old theory. Somewhat like a catharsis. You've got to purge yourself of these emotions, and Lord help anyone who's standing in the way. It's old theory. It's inaccurate. Venting is generally not good for the hearers, and it's not good for the venter. Venting may be good for dryers. It's not good for people. When we vent, we become more likely to vent. And when we are more likely to vent, we are more likely to hurt and say things we shouldn't say. Careful on the venting. Better to think about what you have to say before you vent.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me another day here, talking about the things that matter most. I do want to remind you, as I do every day, that the topics that we discuss on this program have follow-up materials available for you at AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the Cresta Guest Archives there. That, again, is AveMariaRadio.net. Love to have you sign up, too, so we can let you know every day what's coming up on the program. You can do that at the same address. Gerard Verschuren's marvelous book, How Science Points to God. He also has a little-known work of apologetics. I think it's called 40 Answers to Lies About the Catholic Church. It's a great single volume that I think is, people don't talk about it. It's really quite good, very concise. So that's available for you too, Gerard Verschuren. And again, I want you to realize that we're going to continue pursuing how to be faithful in what is going to be an administration, which I suspect is going to be problematic for us. At the same time, as I pointed out, keeping Revelation chapter 21 in mind, let's remember that the new heavens and new earth, the heavenly Jerusalem, is coming down, meeting the earthly Jerusalem. We're seeing a renewed creation. That's the blessed hope, the return of Christ and the renewal of the world he created, the world that we drove into bondage, and the world that he's redeemed, beginning at the cross, burial, resurrection, ascension, the seating at the right hand of the Father, and the sending of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost to give us our mission until he returns. So thanks for being with me. Again, go to AveMariaRadio.net. I'm Al Cresta.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.